Okay, and then that brings me to introducing our main speaker for tonight, Dr. Kevin Roberts. I first met Dr. Roberts at a NAPSIS conference in probably 2006, I think, just when he was starting his work with John Paul the Great Academy in Louisiana, and I was starting my work with the Institute. And I don't know, I kind of looked over at him, oh, that's very nice. I wonder whether he'll succeed or not. You know, he's just getting started, and at least when you first meet Kevin, he's a very low-key guy. You know, he doesn't seem like the guy who's going to stand up and shout and wave. But and we've crossed paths a number of times over the years, and I know he's guided John Paul the Great Academy through the very difficult founding stages, and probably had some times when he thought, you know, it's probably going to fold up, you know, probably this is the end of the line, but never gave up, probably kept a very calm exterior and never really letting people know how bad it was. and he's brought John Paul the Great into a very good situation, a very nice campus, and they've received designation as one of the top 50 Catholic high schools in the country. So I'm very glad that he's here to share his experience with us. Kevin was one of the people that we talked to first. We talked to about 10 schools that we'd worked with when we were thinking about doing this conference to see if they thought it was the time to do it. And it was really important to have his support and confirmation in going forward with this conference idea. He has also brought John Paul the Great Academy to such a position that he feels like it's time for him to move on. He's passed the reins on to a new headmaster there while he's taking up the headship of Wyoming Catholic College. And I hope all of you know about Wyoming Catholic. I think that they're doing great things out there. I was privileged to be involved in their four-year curricular review, and I was very, very impressed with what they're doing and how they're always trying to make it an even better education for their students, to unite their faculty. And I know that they're going to be leaders in the world of Catholic education for years to come. And I was very excited when, after a national search, they picked Dr. Roberts to become the new president. So I also like the fact that, kind of like me, he got his PhD in history. He wrote his dissertation on slavery and the church in colonial America. Probably looked forward to a nice, comfortable academic career. But then didn't do it and went and did the crazy thing of starting the school and now look where he is. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Kevin Roberts.
All right. Okay, this is yours.
The technology must know that I'm about to pick on it, because it worked out well. Thanks for being here. Thank you, Dr. Seeley, for your kind and generous introduction. And I also want to say, on the point of being somewhere where you never would have expected you would be, absolutely, at this point, I thought I would be sitting back, drinking a piña colada after a full week of teaching two classes at some state university. That's how we were trained at the University of Texas. But praise God that my parents and ancestors before them preserved the faith, because I'm doing God's will rather than my own. And I think everyone here knows how that goes. I'm also grateful for Andrew making that point, because on my way up here, I spent the last few days in Washington just to remember how much I do love Wyoming. I called my dad, who's deep into retirement in the Deep South, and he said, well, how are things going? I said, they're going well. I'm driving through upstate New York right now. It's just beautiful. He said, hold on a minute. I thought you moved to Wyoming. And then I'm grateful to Beth, because she taught me how to pronounce the name of this lake. And as a Southerner, I had no idea that it would rhyme with Talladega. I have learned some things the hard way about starting a Catholic school. And by saying that is that I've learned them the hard way, I'm not complaining, because they're worth it. And so if you're anxious, if you're fearful, if you're not sure that your school is going to make it, press on. The worst thing that can happen is that you'll fail. The worst thing that can happen is that you'll fail. And we win in the end. So never be afraid of failure. And what that means is we should never be afraid to experiment. We should never be afraid to be innovative. We should never be afraid to be bold. We should never be afraid to proclaim the gospels from the rooftops. As of course scripture says, and as one of my patron saints for obvious reasons, blessed John Paul the Great would remind us. So tonight what I would like to do is give you some insight into what I've learned. And the theme of this is creating order in a chaotic world. And so necessarily, and in particular as a historian, you know that I have to give you some context. And I'm really grateful to Dr. Seeley for giving me 3 hours. You thought you were having wine and cheese. All kidding aside, as my wife would remind me, I'm not a stand-up comic. Getting down to brass tacks, the importance of what I have to say, if in fact there is any importance, is that one guy with a bunch of great holy people figured out how to make a school work. And any accolades that John Paul the Great Academy has won come not from the brilliance of one person or even the leadership of one person. They come from that collective effort. And I really mean that. We are imperfect instruments. And in spite of ourselves, and in spite of the ideas we have, and in spite of the ways we want to implement those ideas, sometimes God can take what would have been a failure in our understanding and can make it a success. And you understand that, and so I know that I'm preaching to the choir. I just know that along the way, it was really helpful to talk to people who had done that. Talking to Michael Van Hecke, even I think weeks before we had our first year, that was one of the times when I was thinking, what have I gotten myself into? In fact, to put a fine edge on that, I remember very well about that time, just before I went to Ave Maria for our NAPSIS conference, where I met Michael, thinking, we have 110, 115 students registered, we have all our faculty hired, and we do not have a campus. Because this is in the aftermath of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, and where we were in Lafayette, which is the best city in Louisiana, my hometown, doesn't mean anything to you if you're from upstate New York, but you might know it one day. We, of course, were spared the ravages of the hurricanes, but we had become a blessing for many people who had to leave both New Orleans and southwestern Louisiana. And that meant that if you were looking for commercial real estate, in particular south of Interstate 10, you're out of luck. Because even if you could find it, no one was going to insure you. And I remember at that point thinking, well, maybe this is God's sign that this just isn't meant to be. That actually was my will, because I was thinking about how in Louisiana we would say, we're going to crawfish out of this. We're going to back our way out of it. Don't do that. That's you. That's not God. And so I do want to give you a rather orderly assessment of what I've learned. But in order to do that, I do have to create the context. And so to give you a little bit of a roadmap of what I'll be talking about tonight, I do want to talk about that context. And I want to get down to some practical tips, because ultimately I know many of you, if not most of you, are here for practical tips. And ultimately, because I am someone who likes to think or view the world in a 30,000 foot view, I will ultimately retreat back to my comfort zone of the abstract. And it is one abstract idea, and that is instilling wonderment in our students' hearts and minds, that is the secret to formation in a Catholic school. And I would submit to you, and this is where my now good friend Dr. Seeley will know I'm not so laid back, that is where our Catholic schools are failing miserably. And so by saying that, and the comments will be pointed, my intention is neither to offend, nor to insult, nor to be condescending, but to give you some insight into what I've learned. And I understand that for a variety of reasons, geography, grade level, the governance nature of your school, the diocese you're in, that different comments that I make may be less applicable than others. I understand that. But this, I hope, will be helpful for you. And even though I'm now a college president, you need to understand that I've done everything, I think, every role in education, from teaching 12th grade American history, which was a real delight because that's my thing, to teaching K kindergartner's Latin to being the nighttime janitor. So I think I know how a school should run. Not necessarily well, but how it should run. Order is a much contemplated concept, not only in the modern world, but also in our Catholic intellectual tradition. That it has proven elusive throughout the centuries on the geopolitical stage suggests the difficulty of achieving real order, what is, in St. Augustine's work, described as the foundation for real peace. Indeed, in the same way that the mere absence of war does not necessarily equate to peace and order, those of us in the education business might learn an important lesson about what constitutes real order in our schools. Not surprisingly, as with geopolitics, the absence of public discipline problems or the lack of scandalous choices by our students does not, in our Catholic tradition, suggest that we possess real order in our schools. Perhaps, very much the contrary, that simply gives us, our faculty, our parents, and our students a false confidence in the tools we are giving them to fight the tide of the depraved prevailing culture in which we live. Consequently, to some extent this evening, I want to begin by depressing you. Perhaps this will be a tall order, because you have perfected the art of student formation so much that you consider it a science. After all, self-appointed experts in many colleges of education tell us that all education can be reduced to a science, that is, to something always tangible and quantifiable, and therefore, by extension, the very art of educating someone, and even of forming them, is not an art at all. Or perhaps my attempt to depress you will be a tall order, because even though you do recognize that education and formation really are art forms, you nonetheless have developed an effective program of formation for your students. To be sure that is possible, as many schools are reaping the benefits of that success. If that describes your school, be sure to speak up during the conference. Or perhaps I will not be able to depress you, because where you live, at the school where you work, the Holy Spirit has so fully inspired your community that your students have no needs for formation. We might call them and you perfect, but then eventually we would consider you, shall we say, overly optimistic. So let me get back to the business at hand, which, remember, is to depress you. By the way, my purpose in doing so is to jar and jolt all of us, myself included, into the recognition that we in Catholic education, in spite of all our well-intentioned efforts, sacrifices of time, financial expenditures, and whiz-bang scientific ideas about how to educate students, are not getting the job done. And by that, I am speaking in the aggregate. I have no doubt that on an individual level with a student, or a classroom, or even a school, it's happening. But I can tell you, even at great schools where I have been, truly great schools, that there are exceptions to their greatness. So let us come to this with a spirit of humility. The reason for this is twofold. First, the degree to which the culture around us is an obstacle to formation is actually accelerating. Ultimately, what do historians do? We don't memorize dates, we don't memorize names, although we tend to be very good at those two things. We analyze change over time. And I think a historian, in the sense of human behavior, has a particularly good way of understanding when certain changes actually are accelerating. We've seen that throughout human history. And if you don't believe me, then speak to Dr. Seeley, he'll prove it to you. Secondly, we are using many tools from this culture as intended methods of formation, when they ought not be tools of formation. In other words, we need to embrace a bold countercultural program that gives students some well-tested tools for fighting the culture. In order to make this point, I want to look at three categories of challenges to formation: spiritual, academic, and physical. And in some of these, I'll be more specific, and in others, in the interest of time and to facilitate our conversation 3 hours from now, I'll be brief. First of all, I will pick on technology, because it's a problem. It's trite to say that technology gets in the way of our kids' formation. It's trite to say that it's a conduit for evil. But let me tell you, you are mistaken if you're going to stand up and argue with that statement. In fact, any of us who would be willing to do that is a fool. A fool. This is not a screed against social media. It's not a screed against using computers in the classroom. But it is an honest-to-God statement that we are participating, through the use of technology, in a disordered way, in the insidious ways that our students cannot be formed. So do not come to me this weekend and tell me about all the great things your smart board does. I don't care. Give them a book. Give them the Eucharist. Teach them what humans have been doing for 2,000 years and beyond. Sorry, Dr. Seeley, I'm not as laid back as you think. For example, one recent study of college students in industrialized countries, including our own, found that the psychological effects of being away from one's gadget, at least for people that age, are akin to chemical addictions. Consider, for example, the comments of four students from that study. These are direct quotations. One British participant reported, "I am an addict. I don't need alcohol, cocaine, or any other derailing form of social depravity." You know they're British because of the vocabulary. "Or any other derailing form of social depravity. Media is my drug. Without it, I was lost." Another wrote, "I literally didn't know what to do with myself. Going down to the kitchen to pointlessly look in the cupboards became regular routine, as did getting a drink." These are students for whom their gadget was taken away 24 hours. A third said, "I became bulimic with my media. I starved myself for a full 15 hours and then had a full-on binge." If any of you do youth outdoor activities like the Boy Scouts or American Heritage Girls, you know that if you take those away on a camping trip and you get back on the bus or in the van, everyone's in front of the screen. I remember many years ago when I was at Philmont Scout Ranch as a scout. This is, of course, before all of the gadgets. Now we were, at that point, we were just addicted to TV, which of course is an issue. We get off the trail and we're sitting in the laundry room looking at the window of the dryer because it was glass. So I'm not casting a stone because I live in a glass house. A fourth student added, "I felt like a helpless man on a lonely deserted island in the big ocean." And then the professor who administered this study concluded, "Some students said they wanted to go without technology for a while, but they could not, as they would be ostracized by their friends. When the students did not have their mobile phones and other gadgets, they did report, imagine this, that they did get into more in-depth conversations. Quite a number, in fact, reported quite a difference in conversation in terms of quality and depth as a result." And that's my point. This has an impact on social behavior. The addiction to technology by adolescents and others has problems that go beyond withdrawal symptoms in the quality of conversations. Let us make no mistake. Technology is often, not always, often a conduit for information that subverts the very values that families, schools, and church parishes are trying to instill. Consider, for example, another study, this one by the Pew Center, which analyzed in depth the millennial generation, that is, young Americans born after 1980. And I know that's all of you in this room. Not surprisingly, this generation reports a far higher usage and even dependency on technology and media than older generations. Consequently, the information that comes with that technology has also had an impact on millennials' worldview and attitude toward moral questions. For example, people in this generation, keep in mind, this is our students and some of our parents, report far higher acceptance than older generations of out-of-wedlock births, cohabitation, and same-sex couples raising children. It would be fair, therefore, to conclude that when determining how to form our students, we are not just paddling against the current of a devolving culture, but that sometimes the very people for whom we are paddling so hard have actually jumped out of the boat and are contributing to the current themselves. The same is true for more and more families of our students. They're getting younger too. Consequently, their usage of technology, their acceptance of cultural practices that contravene Catholic teaching are all on the rise. that makes every aspect of our jobs at Catholic schools, sometimes just the admissions process, extremely difficult. And yet each of us, to some degree or another, understands that we do have a moral obligation to help others, to be effective witnesses, and to be people of perpetual hope. Let us not forget that the main reason there is a public education system in this country, well, technically, 51, this is one for every state plus the District of Columbia, is because of the church, because of the existence of Catholic schools in the early 19th century in this country. But doing all of that in our schools, even remembering the magnanimous goal we have, the supernatural goal we have as Catholic educators, doing that every single day is very difficult. So spiritual formation is a problem, and obviously I've not talked about all of the obstacles there, but that gives you a sense of what in my experience took a lot of my time as a head of school and what I can tell you already has taken some of my time as a college president. And these are with great kids. These are with kids we would love to have here. And so I'm not making any, obviously not making a moral judgment about them. I'm not even making a criticism of them. This is born out of a great Christian love for them and for an understanding that if we're a teacher or a head of school, we are partly responsible for them. Not chiefly, it's their parents' job, but partly. Let's talk about academics. This, in a lot of ways, is what I like to talk about, being a curriculum guy. And I know for most of you, this will be a comfortable subject as well. The results, however, of study after study suggest that we ought not be comfortable about what's going on. For example, reading habits and reading skills. The well-known scholar, public policy expert, and casino gambler, Dr. Bill Bennett. That's funnier than that. I like Dr. Bennett, it's not a comment against him. Might have to edit that part out. Anyway, he once commented and has repeated over and over, and he's absolutely correct, that in the United States, we have absolutely the best education system in the world in fourth grade. Reading scores, math scores, science scores, critical thinking scores are all among the highest, and in some of those categories, the highest in the world. But something happens between fourth grade and eighth grade. And by eighth grade, we have the worst education system in the industrialized world. And it would be true for one of you to reply, well, Kevin, the standardized test scores among Catholic schools are better. You're right, but they follow the same trend. So the problem exists as well. So that academic problem, which I happen to, in a very opinionated way, think emanates from teaching kids to quote unquote read too early in life, means that they're not lifelong readers. I really don't care if your four-year-old can read. Because unless he or she is 1/100th of 1% of the population, he or she can't really read. And the chances are, if they're reading when they're five, they're not going to be reading as an activity as Dr. Seeley was when he was 10. We want depth of reading. We want quality of reading. We want breadth of reading. We don't want sight reading. And I know that that will create perhaps some tense conversations later. Secondly, what Americans don't know is startling. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which you ought to be familiar with, especially if you're at a high school, doing great work when it comes to understanding the problems of higher education, understanding the limitations of modern American education, yearly through 2011 or so, did an annual study, a quiz of Americans and what they knew. And for a few years, they really focused on college graduates. And you should go to their website, isi.org, and look into some of these studies. They're both entertaining and troubling. For example, only about 38% of Americans can name the three branches of government. And in fact, the percentage goes down from the day one of an average American college student's entrance upon a college campus to the moment he or she receives his diploma. No doubt we create wonderful professionals. I'm a fan of public schools, at least the concept, and of state universities. And of course, we probably have one or two Catholic universities that might need to improve their Catholic identity. You can tell me if that's true. That's what I hear from people. But what I do know is that we're really failing our republic when it comes to instilling the very basic knowledge of how to be a citizen. And if I may make another pointed comment, it would be that I'm most troubled when it comes to the realm of academics about how little in our Catholic schools we teach our kids to be engaged civically. In fact, I find it an affront when people tell me, people, friends, great people, great teachers in Catholic schools, that that's not important. The kids know the catechism, they know St. Thomas Aquinas, they know St. Augustine, they are great witnesses, they're new evangelists. I believe all of that because I'm just sure that it's true. But if they don't know how to actually apply that in the public square, we've not only failed academically, we failed in a moral obligation. The catechism is extremely clear. This is not just an opportunity, a privilege for Catholics. As lay Catholics, it is a moral duty to affect the temporal order. And that's got to start with pre-Kers. There's nothing wrong with Catholic school students singing patriotic songs. That does not constitute the heresy of Americanism. So let us be sure that in addition to all the other things we need to teach, that one of the things we're teaching is a love of country. Not blindly. This is a human enterprise. It's imperfect. There was slavery. There is hatred. But it doesn't mean that in a Catholic school we shy away from it. Wouldn't we want to shine the light on it? I find this one of the biggest limitations of Catholic education as I go around the country. Let's move on to physical formations. At Wyoming Catholic College, this is something close to our heart. I think it's one of our distinguishing characteristics, which isn't to suggest that it's not happening at other places, of course, but I believe that there is some genius to the concept that we can open a young person's or even an older person's mind by first accessing their heart. And I learned that in a literal way, moving from sea level to 6,000 feet of altitude. You really open your heart in ways you think are not possible. And of course, we'll have a session about this tomorrow. This concept comes from Plato. And it's one that has been used at schools over and over. Earlier this morning, I was meeting with a friend of our college in Maryland, and he was telling me about the Catholic military prep school run by Christian Brothers that he attended. And a lot of Catholics we admire in the public square attended, and it closed. And it closed because it ceased being so physically demanding. It ceased being Catholic, really, in its identity. And therefore, there was no reason for it to exist. And so I would point us, without, of course, being uncharitable, to the need for probably for most of us to do more physical exercise. I would point us, not in a Michael Bloomberg way, to the problem of obesity in the United States. That's for us as individuals to handle. It's not for the city of New York to legislate. But these are real problems, and they do fall under our domain in Catholic schools. Because if someone is disorderly and not disciplined in one aspect of formation, they're going to be disorderly and not disciplined in another aspect of their formation. A week ago today, I ran my first half marathon at 6,000 feet. And I did it not just so that I could be alive for a very long time, troubling the academic left, but as a spiritual discipline. Yeah, you know, lazy one night, doing my examination of conscience. I'm lazy one morning, sleeping in, not doing my devotions. Go run 13.1 miles. Looking at a few of you, it's probably not going to be an issue, but for some of us who used to be offensive linemen, that's a bit of a problem. There is some corollary to my half marathon for you and for your students, whatever that might be. It might be half a round of golf. It might be birding. It might be hiking. It might be fly fishing. Find that activity. Develop a passion for it and instill a passion for it among your students. We are going to lose our civilization if we don't address physical formation. I understand that it is more important to be in a state of grace and to receive communion than it is to go run a mile. But I would argue that for a lot of our students, they go hand in hand. They speak to order and they speak to discipline, something that most Americans don't possess. The best anecdote I can give to prove this point is to look at the declining membership in youth athletics leagues. Contrary to the myth, soccer is actually declining in this country. in numbers of young people playing. The numbers of young people playing football declining. The numbers of young people playing baseball declining. It's probably because they're Cincinnati Reds fans, but I haven't figured that out. That was mean. Go Braves. The point is that we have become a nation of spectators and not a nation of doers. And that is most problematic for the age of people who are in our care. So in a Catholic school setting, how can we best handle all of these challenges? To be sure, each of you has done so in one way or another, but even in our Catholic school world, we have challenges. So even if you were to say, okay, Kevin, I have an answer for every one of those challenges that you mentioned, and I'm sure you do. And you might even say, I'll quibble with one or two of them, and that's fine. I just like a good engaging conversation. The problem we have then is the structure, the metastructure of Catholic education in this country. Part of it comes from our own president, who went to Great Britain 2 weeks ago and said, it's time for Catholic schools to come to an end. It's not a partisan statement, that's just a fact from the Associated Press. That's a problem. Any president, regardless of political affiliation, who says that does not understand American history. So we have our work cut out for us. Consider these statistics. In the early 1960s, there were more than 5.2 million students in Catholic schools in the United States. 13,000 Catholic schools at that time in the United States. And then in the 1970s and 80s, a story you know well, I'm sure, there was a steep decline both in the number of schools and in the number of students. By 1990, so let's just say 1960, 5.2 million students, 13,000 schools. By 1990, 2.5 million students and about 9,000 schools. From the mid-90s through 2000, the NCEA reports there was a steady enrollment increase. What does that mean? An increase of 1.3%. I don't know about you, I wouldn't call that steady, but at least it wasn't a decline. Between 2000 and 2013, over 2,000 Catholic schools were reported closed or consolidated. And those of you here in the Northeast know well what consolidation looks like. It's not necessarily always bad, but certainly painful for the people who've invested a lot in those schools. During that same time, 2000 to 2013, the number of students also declined by nearly 700,000, a 25% decline. And the most seriously impacted have been elementary schools. You look at this regionally, you can see that the problem is worst where Catholic schools were started, the older schools. A lot of demographics changed in terms of finances and property tax revenue. The Northeast has been hit the hardest. There are some areas of the country where it's not as bad, but it isn't as good as often is made out to be. I told you I was going to depress you. Today, summer of 2013, there are 6,685 Catholic schools, and the enrollment at the end of this recently concluded school year is just over 2 million, 2,002,000, from 5.2 million in 1960. Those are not only a lot of people, but a lot of souls not being touched by one of the most heroic movements in Western civilization, and that's Catholic education in this country. There are more statistics we can talk about, but I'll think I've made the point, and I'll leave it there. There are many reasons for these declines, and they're sensitive topics. They speak to the nature of religious orders, which up to that point had been heroic in the sacrifices they made. Some of those orders still heroic in the sacrifices they're making for schools. And they speak to cultural differences, or differences in opinion about our culture, about society, how they have evolved in Catholic schools sticking to a certain mindset. But they also speak to those schools that attempted to change, so to speak, with the times. Those are the schools that failed. The schools that are still alive are those, generally, at least in greater representation, that are Orthodox, little or Orthodox, that are very upfront about swimming against the cultural tide, and necessarily that have found creative ways to finance their education. Because ultimately, you can have all the great ideas in the world. You can have the best teachers. You can have the best administrator. You can have the best board. You could even have religious teaching at your school. But if the finances don't work, you ultimately have to pay the bills. And I know that most of you in this room have lived through that. I know that I have. And it's not fun, but I can tell you in hindsight, it's worthwhile. So if you're living through that right now, stay the course. Fight. There's a priest friend who's visiting our school in Louisiana 2 years ago. Just as we were trying to figure out how a school that was a few hundred thousand dollars in debt, static enrollment, was going to be able to purchase a 40-acre property that had been the novitiate site for the De La Salle Christian Brothers, great heroic men who founded a majority of the Catholic schools in Louisiana. They were down to four brothers in retirement at the site from having had nearly 200 young men in formation in 1962. And unfortunately for these great men, all of whom are my friends now, these four, they know that the end is near, not only for their life, as they now joke, but also for that province, for that order. And only recently have they come to grips with that. That's 40 years or so into this problem. But anyway, getting back to our school, this priest friend visits, and he says, "Kevin, this is a great place to have your bunker hill." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "That high ground over there," because this is in the middle of flat Louisiana, "is where you pull the trigger. That's where you take a stand, you get out of the trenches, and you say, we're going to make this work because of all the reasons I've just listed for you." So your school where you are probably is your bunker hill. And I hope that it isn't as difficult as it was for us. We went to close on the property. We were like the chihuahua that had caught the rear bumper of a Suburban or even a Ford Excursion. How are we going to slow this thing down? How are we going to digest it? And we found a way to do it through the generosity of great people. And 10.5 hours before closing, everything evaporated. And we had to go and tell the brothers, "We can't purchase it. The money you were expecting isn't coming to you." And without a campus, we weren't even sure among our board members that we were going to survive. And that was 13 months ago from today. And in 13 months, actually in a span of 5 weeks, we raised $500,000 to sort of right the ship. We also raised through investors and some creative investing and donating $1.1 million to purchase a campus. And this year, this fall, my successor, who will be a much greater headmaster than I was, Mr. Peter Fletcher, will enjoy an enrollment growth from 192 students to 240. That's what staying the course means. And I hold it up not as some example of my leadership or courage, because I didn't think we were going to make it, but collectively, the power of prayer. And collectively, having honest conversations about what the problems and the limitations are. And it's in that spirit that I mention this. But I started my comments tonight wanting to focus on wonderment. And in this next part of my talk, I really want to focus on that. Aristotle begins his metaphysics. He begins his metaphysics. These are the first sentences by stating, "All men by nature desire to know. An indication of this is the delight we take in our senses. For even apart from their usefulness, they are loved for themselves, and above all, others the sense of sight. Even when we are not going to do anything, we prefer seeing, one might say, to everything else. The reason is that this, most of all the senses, makes us know and brings to light many differences between things." The next paragraph. "By nature, animals are born with the faculty of sensation. And from sensation, memory is produced in some of them, though not in others. And therefore, the former are more intelligent and apt at learning than those which cannot remember. Those which are incapable of hearing sounds are intelligent, though they cannot be taught. For example, the bee, and any other race of animals that may be like it. And those which, besides memory, have this sense of hearing can be taught." This is getting us to wonderment, which I'll mention in a moment, but I think right now, my interjection would be, what a call to arms for memorization. What a call to arms that it's not sinful to have young kids, when their heads are like sponges, memorizing things, reciting things, especially beautiful poetry. Or even, God forbid, something patriotic that supports the American Republic. Now consider what Aristotle says about wonder. It is owing to their wonder that men both now begin and at first began to philosophize. So don't tell me there's no room for a philosophy class in your high school. Don't tell me there's no room for logic and rhetoric for your 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders. That's what we must be doing in our schools. And I understand if you have a small school and you're over budget for your staff and your faculty aren't really confident about teaching it, it's better to try and do a 20% good job than it is not to. Do it. Be bold. So wonderment and imaginativeness are obviously abstract concepts, and there are many ways of getting to that. There are many things that we could read. Aristotle would be a good place to start. Plato would be a good place to start. In our 21st century setting, which of course is my obligation to you to discuss tonight, I would suggest that it also begins with something that is in the charism of the school, sort of the DNA of the school. And that is what Aristotle also calls magnanimity. There's one writer, Alexander Havard, who wrote this book, Virtuous Leadership. If you've not read that, and even if you're a teacher and not yet an administrator, you need to read it. Havard, H-A-V-A-R-D, Virtuous Leadership. And he focuses on this Aristotelian concept of magnanimity. And what's relevant about this to my comments tonight is that it speaks to civic virtue, the classical virtue our founders of the Republic understood. But it also speaks to, even though this predates Christianity, the virtue that you and I as Catholics understand. In a lot of ways, the only way a man or a woman, or a boy or a girl, could be magnanimous is to have fulfilled the definition of the virtues we understand as Catholics. It's sort of the queen or the king of virtues. And what it means, ultimately, what it can be defined as, is a greatness of spirit. An orientation of one's entire being, mind, heart, soul, and body, towards something bigger than ourselves. Isn't that what you do every day? If you're a teacher, no matter the school, you're magnanimous. There might be some self-interest there, but I am sure in this room that the magnanimous objectives outweigh the self-interest. In any event, I think it is inculcating among our students this striving of the spirit toward great things that gets us to wonder. You can't be striving toward great things, I don't think, if you're in front of a screen several hours a day. You can't be striving for great things if you don't have some passion in the outdoors. It could be as simple as taking a non-aerobic walk around the lake. There's no way that someone's soul and spirit and body and mind can be magnanimous without that physical formation. Nor, in our Catholic understanding, could it be possible if they're not in a state of grace or striving toward that. So all of these things come together. What is the enemy? What's the opposite, definitionally, of magnanimity? Being pusillanimous, being small-minded. Who in this room wants to be accused of being small-minded? It's a real insult. So, given what you do, I want to propose to you, or if you find it perhaps a little elementary, then you can imagine we're proposing this to our students, a question. What is an integer, and what are its origins? Simple mathematical question. What's an integer, and what are its origins? If you say that an integer is a whole number, that is a number with no fractions or decimals, then you're right, partially. You're right about the first question. If you're like most people, however, you would probably dance around part two, and that's where things get unclear. Never quite answering the question. That's the question about the origins. For example, one of our younger students might say that an integer's origins are in some really sharp mathematician's textbook. Or someone, you know, maybe an engineer's child might say, well, Dr. Roberts, it's in chapter 2, page 17. I have a child at home who would say that. And I would say, yes, Philip, you would be right. That's its origins in that textbook. But an older, better read student in a classical school, especially one that's Catholic, might observe correctly that the very concept of an integer was discussed by the ancient Greeks, but that student would likely make the erroneous conclusion that the ancient Greeks had resolved the issue. Keep in mind, after all, that the very concept of negative numbers was not generally accepted until the 19th century. Not surprisingly, that two millennia-long squabble over the existence of negative numbers paralleled the inability of mathematicians and philosophers to determine the origins of the integer. And I know that this flies against everything the core curriculum suggests, but I guess there are a couple of exceptions to the core curriculum being the best thing we could ever do. Though our post-industrialist, atomized, secularist, relativist, subversive, segmented, and shall I say ineffective, American education system preaches that math is math, science is science, and history is history, the reality is that all knowledge, even that which is part of a distinctive academic discipline, is unified. And so it would make perfect sense to us, for example, that many philosophers have directly engaged this question of the nature, definition, and origins of the integer. In fact, the work of Euclid, Socrates, Aristotle, and Plato remains fundamental to this question. Just don't tell that to those who think that the foundations of education began a mere century ago with the likes of John Dewey, William James, and whoever invented smart boards and Wikipedia. Regarding the origins of the integer, the question still causes controversy in certain circles. For in a secular society that has become so hostile to truth, to natural law, and to God himself, explaining the unexplainable without real truth is rather confounding. Hence the conclusion of 19th century German mathematician Leopold Kronecker, who desperately tried to explain the origins of the integer using only mathematics. It was Kronecker who famously remarked, "God made natural numbers. All else is the work of man." And so there's your answer. The origin of the integer is God. Good answer. In this brief exercise, I hope I've demonstrated several key ideas that are relevant to us and to our students. First, the seemingly simple is sometimes complex. Second, the seemingly complex is sometimes simple. And third, our confusion about which is which has its origins in a centuries-old intellectually devolving process with the misnomer of the Enlightenment. As Catholic school professionals concerned about the formation of our students, you know many facets of this story. Chief among them, perhaps, is that while most Americans are ill-equipped to trace our Republic's modern problems back to the Enlightenment, we know that is where they can be found. In other words, you pick one controversy, one public policy question, one disturbing demographic trend today, and we could connect it to some degree or another with a disordered Enlightenment project of elevating man's power to the point of minimizing and ultimately eliminating God. And though many people outside our world of Catholic schools may not fully appreciate it, our magic pill, our secret sauce, is not merely our robust Catholicity, but the necessary intellectual formation that gives our Catholicity such vigor. It is that last ingredient that is so terribly lacking even in schools whose faculty strive for well-intentioned aims. And here is where magnanimity is important. We are striving as a faculty towards something great, and that is a curriculum perhaps we're not fully familiar with. That's why we have the Institute. We're a faculty who would love to have more Catholicity in our humanities program, in particular history. That's why there's the Catholic Textbook Project. There are resources at your disposal. And I would say, being a John Paul the Great guy, that this is also our moral obligation as members of the new evangelization. We must be doing this. We can't be in some corner reading our book. We have to be on the rooftops proclaiming the gospel. And the gospel, of course, isn't just about the love and charity we should have for every single person who comes into our life. But it should also be, especially in this wonderfully resourced republic, about reason as well, and putting those two things together. So let's remember the comment from John Paul II and Fides et Ratio, that faith and reason are like two wings on which the human spirit rises to the contemplation of the truth. So if you ask me the question, Kevin, how do you form spiritually Catholic elementary, middle, or high school students? One of my answers is going to be focused on academics. It has to be on academics. In other words, let us strive for the concept of the integer, which represents the wholeness of life, the unified nature of knowledge, and the faith we, in just the most basic sense, must always maintain in the uncaused cause. Remember, as you embark on this, and I'm getting to my practical steps, that you're not alone. You're here this weekend. You will leave with more ideas to implement than you could ever do in 10 whole years. But at least you have those ideas, and at least you're fighting. And you can also know that some of us are so hard-headed that we only learn from trial and error. And we perhaps make more error than we do success. But I think that's also the spirit of a classical school as well. This reminds me of my good friend and scholar, who's a good friend of some of you in this room, Winston Elliott, who runs a very popular blog now, The Imaginative Conservative, named after the great historian Russell Kirk and his work. Consider Winston's comments from his reflection this past Solemnity of the Ascension, for which at Holy Mass we hear the words of Matthew 28:19. Go therefore, make disciples of all nations, baptize them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Winston concluded, the mission is given. The Lord has spoken and the disciples are given their orders. Go and make disciples of all the nations. Not just preach and make converts, make disciples. Disciples don't only believe, they strive to follow Jesus' commands. True disciples center their lives, all that they do, on Jesus. Their world is transformed so that they view culture, economics, politics, and family life through the lens of Christ. Jesus commands that his disciples go to all the nations and teach them to observe all the commands I gave you. This is our task as disciples of Jesus. Who are we teaching? Or are we waiting for someone else to respond to the Great Commission? So to put these ideas into some practical form, and I guess also thinking about apostles, I have 12 practical tips. I have 2 hours and 11 minutes left, so I'm not going to be using PowerPoint, by the way, if you haven't figured that out. I used to. We can talk about that over wine and cheese. 12 practical tips. These are designed to inspire wonderment, to emphasize order, to form witnesses, and to make saints, including ourselves. What can you do in your school that works? And these aren't all from John Paul the Great Academy, but a few of them are. First of all, reject utilitarianism. That's one of the evils of the American Republic, the modern American Republic. Do something for its inherent value, not because it leads to something else. Read Plato for the sake of reading Plato. Take a walk at the lake, not only because it's good for you and you feel better and it's beautiful, much more beautiful than Talladega, I will say, but because you can. Because it's inherently a good and beautiful thing to do. And those are the kinds of things that we need to do in our school. Let me give you a very specific example. Louisiana is such an interesting state. One of the many ways in which it's interesting is that the state, which has better or other schools that it ought to be worrying about, rather interferes with private schools. And I was in the minority in saying that, but I'm a little radical that way. And in particular, I get a little hot under the collar when a very nice and well-intentioned individual in the state capitol tells us that we should have PE from 1:11 p.m. to 1:47 p.m. instead of 1 p.m. to 1:30. Don't you have better things to worry about? My point is that you really do need to untether yourself from whatever the constraining aspects of the educracy is governing you. And to some extent, you've got to be approved, you've got to be accredited, and all of those things, but there's more freedom there than perhaps you let on. be bold, have PE when you want, and teach philosophy. Secondly, remember rhetoric. Little kids should be memorizing poetry. At many schools, Catholic and otherwise, young kids, some as young as 4, memorize poems, and they come in front of a room like this, in front of their peers, and they stand erect, and they practice their comportment, they speak from their diaphragm, and they use very well-intentioned body language. Your students should be doing that. There was a time when, in Catholic schools, every student in a Catholic school did that. And you know what that produces? It produces young people who, when they're 9 and 19 and 49, can come in front of a group of people and do that without even blinking. If you're not doing that in your school, you're not serving your students well. And it's hard, because we teach Americans to be sloppy. If you want to change society, you have to comport yourself in a way that influences others. Third, minimize technology. I can tell you what that looked like at John Paul the Great Academy. You can vary that according to degree, but if you tell me that your students have cell phones and iPads and a smart board in every classroom, we might have a conversation. At John Paul the Great Academy, we had none of it. We had no smart boards, we had no iPads, and we reached the conclusion that teachers should turn off their cell phones, certainly not allowed in the classroom, but just immerse yourself in the great conversation. One of the reasons that a classical curriculum works isn't just that what's going on for the 45 minutes, or hopefully longer than that, 75 minutes in the classroom is really brilliant. It's that it's part of, it's one link in a really big chain. And it's part of the great conversation. And in order to have a great conversation, your faculty and your parents and your administrators and your friends of the school have to participate in it. It's hard to do when you're checking your textbook messages or posting some picture of what you ate for lunch on Facebook. Fourth, remember God's first book, The Great Outdoors. And I know that some of your campuses may be in extremely urban, concrete heavy settings, but you can look up, the sky's still there. And some of you are in really glorious places where there's a lot of greenery and you can very naturally inculcate that wonder. That's where wonderment comes from. That's why at Wyoming Catholic College, when the freshmen arrive, they learn wilderness first aid, and on day 4, they're on a 3-week expedition in the Wind River Mountains to open this. And there are other ways of doing that. I'm not suggesting that's the only way, because we have obviously two other great Catholic colleges represented here, and Thomas Aquinas College and Ave Maria University. Fifth, unstructured time. Why would we, in a Catholic school, theologically teach the concept of free will and not give our students the opportunity to exercise that? Unstructured time. For little kids, elementary school, it might be at centers on the periphery of the room or at their desk, reading time, and it may be certain parameters that are given. Here are 3 books you can choose from. You can draw, or you can read. For older kids, I think there ought to be benches around your campus where they can just sit outside. And maybe they're having a conversation with their classmates, hopefully they are, and it might be about something that's really pretty inane, but at least they're talking to each other. And you know, if you didn't think about it already, that the depth and quality of that conversation is better than you thought it would be. Sixth, please teach them civic engagement. Go read paragraph 2441 of the Catechism. That's our moral obligation, to tend to the temporal order. So it's not fair for any of us to complain that Bishop XYZ isn't saying enough about policy ABC. It's his job to make sure the sacraments are provided and the formation is there and the catechesis is there so that we stand up and say that. And if that isn't your thing, fair enough. But if you're a teacher or a school administrator, it is your thing. It's a moral obligation. And I'm not suggesting by any stretch of the imagination partisanship. Catholicism transcends everything. But you aren't being partisan or political, although I don't think political as an adjective is a pejorative term, when you're being engaged in some question in the public square, when you know the song, the words, the Star Spangled Banner, or you can sing God Bless America, or you say the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of the school day, or you read about great Americans. It's part of who we are as Catholics. Seventh, please remember, girls and boys are different. And boys are the biggest victims of the American education system. Boys ought not be feminized. Boys ought not be disciplined and treated like girls. Boys ought not be expected to sit in front of a whiteboard or smart board or any other kind of board for 7 hours a day, because they will be bored. They need to be up and active. And they need to be disciplined in doing so, but guess what? When you give them the freedom to be up and active, they will be more disciplined. It's amazing how that works. Eighth, form your faculty. And if you're a faculty member here, know that I'm saying this on your behalf. This is not some administrator pointing his finger saying, you better be formed. No, you're part of the team. You're in the trenches. And so if you're lacking something, maybe in your spiritual knowledge or your academic preparation or your physical formation, speak up. Go to your administrator and say, man, I would really like to improve in this aspect of my life. We as administrators do that ourselves. So there's a certain spirit of professional humility that needs to happen. And administrators, be sure you're focused on your faculty. They get the job done, and they're heroes. Ninth, remember that your parents need to be formed. This is, if you read the literature that's worth reading about not just Catholic schools, but private schools, Christian schools, this is increasingly an issue for school administration. And not just in the realm of communication, but really formation. And it's delicate because we don't want to be condescending and we don't want to suggest that we know everything. But if this is something that you've been struggling with or that you're curious about, I would suggest you read the work of Dr. James Stinson. He is the best. He is a veteran headmaster who was involved in the founding of two schools. He's kind of writes in a crusty way, which I guess is why I like him. Wonderful gentleman, wonderful Catholic. But he's got some really concise essays available for free on the web that you can distribute to your parents. We started doing that at John Paul Academy 2 years ago, and I can tell you I had a 75% reduction in phone calls from parents. That is not an exaggeration, and I was keeping track. It is a direct result of the school saying, look, we don't have all the answers. We're not trying to tell you how to parent, but these are sort of the principles that we use on a day-to-day basis. And it goes beyond kind of the abstract nature of our family handbook, which is pretty pie in the sky, but very right kind of stuff. Dr. James Stinson. It's also got some great essays about forming girls and forming boys. And if you have little kids in your house, be sure to know him well. Tenth, talk all the time about vocation discernment. Not in an artificial, superficial way where we're a Catholic school, so we're going to have a vocation director from our favorite religious order twice a year. That's great. It's better than nothing. But this has to be part of what you're doing all the time. It has to be a natural thing. It ought to come from the administrator of the school and the faculty. And by vocation discernment, I would always tell the students at John Paul Academy, I look forward to our priestly ordinations. I look forward to our young women taking their vows. I look forward to the many wonderful married couples we will have from John Paul the Great Academy, and I look forward, and we have one teacher, who is leading a consecrated single life, all of the vocations. And we're going to unite in prayer to pray for those. And that way the students who are really kind of put off, or the families who are really kind of put off about talk regarding religious vocations, are sort of allayed. Okay, this is a place where there are some vocations coming out. Interestingly, some people find that a problem. We've had 33 graduates from John Paul the Great Academy. Seven of them are seminarians in the Diocese of Lafayette, Louisiana. And I had a call from a parent one time, six girls, great guy, prospective parent, and he said, Kevin, you're running that school that produces all those priests? I said, well, not yet, they're all seminarians. He said, well, that's just too religious for us. I said, why don't you pray about that? Because we're not changing. But it takes a lot of nurturing not to change. And we actually have our first married couple from upperclassmen in the first first year of John Paul the Great Academy. We're waiting for the young ladies to catch up, but I'm told that discernment for them takes a little bit longer. 11th. I have three girls in my house, so that's not an anti-woman comment. 11. It's all about relationships. Know the name, middle name, address, and pertinent details of every one of your students. And at John Paul the Great, where we go pre-K through 12th, the pre-K teacher knew the high school kids, and the high school teachers knew the pre-K kids. We organized duty assignments that way. Our kindergarten teacher went on two March for Life pilgrimages with us. And not just because we asked her, she wanted to. Because in a Catholic school, everyone feels like they're part of the team. And that's where good mentorship and formation is going to happen, those relationships. And obviously, we have to be aware and sensitive to safe environment and all of that. I'm assuming that that's taken care of at your school. But it really is all about relationships, because 20 years, 30 years, 50 years down the road, you and I can vouch for wanting to talk to that teacher who had that conversation with us, whatever that conversation was. 12th, and finally, pray well. If a parent hasn't called you and said you pray too much at your school, then you're not praying enough. Start the day in prayer. Begin and end each class meeting in prayer. Pray the Angelus at noon. End the day in prayer, preferably singing the Salve Regina. Do it briefly. Be sensitive to the students being young. Don't get mad at them when they express some irritation. But explain, treat them as a fellow human being, why we're doing it. And of course, have Holy Mass as often as you can. One thing I learned just a year ago was that while we were always going to have Mass as often as we could, which for us was once a week, we didn't have an official chaplaincy at the school, that adoration was just as powerful in terms of spiritual growth for the students. We have a perpetual adoration chapel at John Paul the Great, but even exposition of the Blessed Sacrament in the second, what we call big chapel at the Academy, was very powerful. And so sometimes for 5 or 10 or 15 minutes, you can get in a spiritual formation sense, the same power that you would even get from Mass. And that makes sense to you and me because we know that it's the Eucharist. And be sure that you're praying to your saints, whoever they may be. At John Paul the Great, in addition to our patron, we had a special devotion to St. John Chrysostom, patron of speakers, because we emphasize communication and rhetoric. To St. Thomas More, because we want to create leaders in the public square, and to St. Jose Maria, because we believe in excellence in all things and doing everything, even ordinary things, in complete excellence. In that spirit, let me begin to wrap up here. I've decided to cut this short from 3 hours and just down to one. St. Jose Maria wrote, "A person who does not choose with complete freedom an upright code of conduct sooner or later ends up being manipulated by others. He will lead a lazy, parasitic existence at the mercy of what others decide. He will let himself be blown to and fro by any wind whatsoever, and will always be others who make up his mind for him. These are waterless clouds, carried hither and thither there by the winds, and we must do something about them." May God bless you. May He bless your students. And may He bless the work of our hands. Thank you.
Can I take two questions?
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
I just like, you mentioned getting a conversation going. I thought maybe we just take two questions before we head over. Any questions right now?
All right. I just wanted to ask this because your comments on technology are not necessarily contradictory to my thoughts, but how do you reconcile Benedict XVI's direction with regard to technology in the world?
Great question. Thank you for asking that. I debated the unofficial chaplain of our school about that 2 years ago, and we were fellow debaters at the same high school, and he's a big social media guy, and he adopted the position that apparently the Pope Emeritus was advocating, which is that we have an obligation to participate in social media and what the Holy Father called new media. And I took the position that that's not what the Holy Father was saying. And as it turns out, I think my friend was right, and I was wrong. And what I mean by that is not that we need to run from this meeting and go check on Facebook, but that in the same argument, the same argument that I would make, that we need to be engaged in the public square, my friend Father Sibley was saying, Kevin, I'm going to apply that to the new media. That is, we can't concede that as Roman Catholics, and that's right. But what I would say, and I ended up winning the debate in terms of the vote, just for the record, was that it's not a moral obligation for every single individual. And by that I mean that some students, in particular your young men, are going to be less equipped to do that in a properly ordered way. And there I'm not talking about the obvious issue with some websites. I'm talking about just not having self-control with what seems to be a really innocent video game, for example. I cannot tell you the number of lives that have been ruined just by video games. And I'm not even talking about Facebook and worse things on the internet. So I would say that if you're going to adopt that position, which is fine with me, that you've got to give your students, especially your young men, the tools to have self-control. So you might say this would be an appropriate amount of time per day to be social media, to listen to this kind of music. One of the tricks that I used was at the end of school at dismissal, the kids would get their iPods out and the earbuds go in, and I would walk down the hall and I would listen. And that seems very invasive. I was told that I was violating their constitutional rights, and then I told them, you don't have constitutional rights, which isn't really true, but they believed me. They believed me. And then one of my theology faculty members said, Dr. Robert St. Thomas Aquinas said you can't ever lie, even a white lie. I said, I'm a historian, not a theologian. But your question is very good, and it's one that we deal with all the time. With the young ladies, I have found that the sin of gossip happening not face-to-face is the biggest problem. And so we would have speakers come in. We would talk about that right after our morning prayer. 30 seconds, 40 seconds, sometimes too much is actually less effective. And so I think we need to model that as adults as well. And that was Father Sibley's point. And I'll have to let him know later tonight, maybe via Facebook, that once again I admitted that ultimately he won that debate. Thanks for the question.
One more.
Mike?
Kevin, I just because of the textbooks and everything, I'm dealing with a lot of regular diocesan Catholic schools. And we're finding we're in over 40 schools in LA that we meet with them to do in-service. And we're finding a lot of movement towards some of these basic 12 items that you mentioned. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you have any? This is a great list, so maybe that's all you can give me. But do you think there are three or four or five things that we should focus on? Because I bet many of us have we rub elbows with parish schools.
Mm-hmm.
So it's our parish schools.
Sure.
What are some of the few that you would think are the most important to focus on for schools?
Thank you for that question. That is probably for a lot of people here tonight and around the country a very important question. I would say that number one would be something we can't still take for granted, although there's been progress, and that is making sure that there's a really full sacramental life happening on campus. That's the single most important. We had confessions twice a week. Mass once a week, confessions twice a week. We had a retired priest who had been the superintendent of schools in our diocese coming on Wednesdays, and the confession line was always full, you know, which is good. And I have been surprised, which is not to pick on our parochial and diocesan school brethren, that confession wasn't that regular. And so I would say I've seen the fruit of that, not only for students, but also for faculty. So that's number one. Number two, I actually would say outdoors. And while I understand physical education in a formal sense is a great thing, making sure that there is some outdoors wilderness component is very important. We were just beginning to do that at our school, following the model of a non-Catholic but Christian school in our area. And there's a lot of fruit that can be reaped from that. Figuratively and literally, some of these schools really like to develop a partnership with some gardening organization, and which is a really nice development tool, by the way, because it gives you access to some non-Catholic funds. And that would be second. And number three would be, boys are boys. Please let them be boys.
You're going to be around for another till Saturday?
Till Saturday morning.
Saturday morning. So I'm going to call this session to an official close. We're going to go over for wine and cheese. What room?
In the dining room.
In the dining room. And so please join us out there. I think that one of the things we've hoped for as a great good of this conference is you all meeting one another and starting to just talk and having the freedom to figure out what you need to know and who to get it from. And so the wine and cheese will start things flowing. And Dr. Roberts will be around through Saturday and or Saturday morning and able to talk.